Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I have a wonderful guest who's in Chapel Hill to promote her new book, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Casey Sepp is a wonderful new writer, writes for The New Yorker, and this book, Furious Hours, has already makes her a New York Times bestseller. Casey, you say you're writing two stories, but centered on Harper Lee. What are the three stories?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I think the book is a little odd in that it's somewhat about Harper Lee, and I think that's what draws a lot of people to it. But it's mostly about this true crime story that she tried to turn into a book herself in the 70s. So the first two-thirds of the book are about a murder story in a small town in Alabama, and the accused was a Baptist minister, and he had the same lawyer for 10 years who then, if you can believe it, turned around and defended the man who murdered him. So he defended, you know, both the reverend and the vigilante.
Got everybody off
is the spoiler alert. So the first two-thirds of the book is about them and about where they were from and their lives and those trials. And the last third of the book is about Harper Lee and her effort to try and write about this case.
Well, the interesting character that we only know about because you wrote this book, because Harper Lee never finished the book, is we call him the preacher, but Will.
Yeah, Will Maxwell, who's born in 1925 and born into one of the most rural counties in Alabama, Coosa County, and grew up on Lake Martin and, you know, was born to sharecroppers, served in the Army, came back to Alabama after his Army service and did a lot to make a living. He was a pulpwooder and he worked at a rock quarry and he worked at a cotton mill, but he was most well known for his preaching. And so he did that on the side of all those other jobs. And he was known for that until he was known for murdering family members for the insurance money.
Well,
his reputation took a sharp turn.
The great experience for white people is to visit an African-American church, a black church, and to hear the enthusiastic preaching and the calls to the altar and the emotional singing. And it's a real experience. What was his preaching? Fiery damnation preaching, or was it self? You know.
Yeah, I mean, you've really caught on to why the Reverend was so well known and well sought after. He was a very charismatic preacher, and he had a very deep knowledge of Scripture, and he actually had a very eloquent way of speaking. And I was able to see some of that from the court records. So he was obviously deposed many times, and there are transcripts of different trials of his, and you can just see it's a very strange and, you know, sui generic way of speaking, and you can imagine how compelling it was. He actually had very little formal education, but being so steeped in Scripture and in the hymnody of the Baptist Church, he was just a charismatic presence. And so even though he never had a full-time parish, he moved around to different parishes and he led revivals and he did marriages and funerals and that sort of thing. And he was very sought after and just right. I mean, no matter what he was doing, if he was pulpwooding or working at the rock quarry, he was always Preacher Maxwell or the Reverend, because that's the thing for which he was best known.
He did not have anything close to a full-time job preaching.
How
did he make his way and spend all this time preaching and not get paid for it?
Yeah, I mean, these are small rural parishes and they can't afford a full-time preacher and, you know, they might do a free love offering, you know, that day during the service. And so he was making money, but not enough for it to be his full-time job.
He was like other preachers sometimes.
Yeah, I guess.
Women were attracted to him and he was not. Well, there were stories that he was running around a little bit.
Yeah, womanizing, I guess, is the mm-hmm. kind of colloquialism from the time. And so, right, he was married. He got married when he was 20 years old and was married for a long time to the same woman. But during the course of that marriage, he had several affairs, and they weren't particularly well known at first, but he actually legitimated an illegitimate child and did that formally in the court system. And I think that's part of what brought these relationships to light. And when his first wife was found murdered, the police who were investigating him started to realize all the women he was involved with. And that was really, they thought, the kind of primary financial motive. He was not just leading one life, but several. And so the reason he had been so entrepreneurial is he was supporting not one family, but several.
His wife was murdered? And who did it?
Yeah, in August of 1970, the Reverend was supposedly in Auburn, Alabama, preaching a revival. And he claimed he came home and his wife wasn't there, and he went to bed, and he woke up in the middle of the night and finally wondered where she had been. But the police who investigated that murder thought right away that he had done it, and he had no alibi. And in fact, a neighbor of his was going to testify in court that he had called his wife at home and lured her out of the house to exactly where her body had been found. Now, what was tricky for the police was that woman then changed her testimony, and they couldn't figure out why. She gave the Reverend an alibi, and a few months after that acquittal, she became the second Mrs. Maxwell.
Mrs. Dorcas?
Dorcas, yeah. So they figured that was why she had perjured herself at the trial.
Well, you were very careful in not coming to conclusive conclusions about this, but did the preacher kill his wife?
So there's a reason I do that. And, you know, I think that we're lucky we live in a country where we really do have a pretty serious system of law and order. And we tend to abide by the belief that people are innocent until proven guilty. And so even though the Reverend was the prime suspect in all of these cases, strictly speaking, he was never convicted. So that's why I tread lightly. But, you know, if you ask me, everybody I interviewed about these cases thinks he did it. And not only that he murdered his first wife, but that he murdered his second wife, a nephew, a brother, and also a stepdaughter.
But never convicted.
Never convicted,
never
right.
Convicted. A whole string of people died under mysterious circumstances. Was any motive for this?
Yeah. So one of the reasons, aside from all of those deaths kind of resembling one another, they were staged to look like car accidents. Aside from that, the Reverend held life insurance policies on all those family members. So part of the reason the police, and then when it got kicked up to the Alabama Bureau of Investigation, those agents, the reason they were all convinced he'd done it is that he profited greatly off of all those deaths.
She made his money by marrying and then killing his wives. Is that
yeah?
And his other relatives.
And you know, I quote this letter in the book. It was just a very different time for life insurance. So the standards were lower, and there was kind of less front end work. And these companies would issue $1,000, $3,000, $5,000 policies kind of on a lark. And in the case of the Reverend, you know, there's a letter I quote in the book where one insurance company is terminating their relationship with him, and they indicate the 14 relatives who he held policies on, and that included the infant child he had just legitimated. So he was really, you know, he was taking out policies on a lot of people, and then only a few of them turned up dead. But that is exactly why the police said the motive is the insurance money.
Could he do that today?
No, not really. And I definitely like to say the book is not a how-to for many reasons, but especially because, you know, if you've ever taken out a policy, or for folks listening, when you go to an insurance agent now, you know, typically the insured has to have a medical exam to verify their eligibility, and, you know, a notarized document confirms that they know there's a policy being executed on them. And at the time the Reverend was doing it, there were none of those standards. You know, he would complete these mail-away forms just like little 3x5 cards, basically, and mail them in. And in his case, he was just forging, you know, the signature of the insured. And instead of using their home address, he was using his home address. So none of these family members really knew that he had the policies on them.
One of the things that was interesting to me is how sloppily the insurance companies responded to this risk and or not to the claims.
Sure,
they did object, but.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question. So some listeners might remember, for a long time, you could walk into an airport and put a quarter in a vending machine and get a life insurance policy and for the duration of your flight. And that ended when someone bombed a plane and tried to cash out all the policies. So life insurance, like any financial market, is responsive to fraud and predation. You know, it's hard to anticipate. People are very creative. It's hard to anticipate all the ways they'll try to defraud you. So once it happens, you try and learn your lesson. And when it came to these smaller companies, you know, one thing to say right away is the Reverend was smart. He wasn't taking out, you know, 20 policies with one company. He was taking out, they were siloed. You know, he was taking out $1,000 here, $3,000 with a company in Illinois, $5,000 with a company in Texas. And it was hard for them, because the industry was so siloed, to know that the same person was cashing out, you know, in one case, 14 policies on one person, you know, one of those wives. It was a lot of smaller policies that added up. And So they were frustrated once they found out. And actually, for the most part, they found out because those out-of-state companies were contracting with local law firms to represent them in court. And it was the lawyers who realized, hey, wait a minute. Didn't you have a case with the, you know, didn't we do this before? Hey, didn't you go up against that guy, Tom Radney, from Tallapoosa County with some reverend who'd murdered somebody? And so they figured it out and they really did fight it in court. But, you know, the second part of the book is about a lawyer who was very good at his job and he prevailed over and over again in recovering those insurance claims.
We're going to talk about that later. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Casey Sapp. We're talking about her great new book, Furious Hours, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.T. Martin. I'm visiting with the author of a new book, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee by Casey Sapp.
D.T., it's great to be here.
Welcome.
Yeah.
For those who joined us late, you better track down this program and listen to the first part of it. It's an extraordinary story of how a minister committed insurance fraud and murder to get wealth, and it's an invitation to write a story like In Cold Blood about this.
Yeah.
So tell us how Harper Lee got involved in this story.
Yeah, you've brought up the right title. So Harper Lee, actually, it's one of these great curiosities of geography. Truman Capote was not born in Monroeville, Alabama, where she was, but he had some family there, and he had a really broken home as a kid. So for a while, he got sent to live with those cousins in Monroeville. And those cousins lived right next door to the Lees. So Harper Lee and Truman Capote knew one another as children. And, you know, they wrote stories and poems together as kids. And when they grew up and he went out to Kansas to write In Cold Blood, he took Harper Lee along. And she was his research assistant. And she learned a lot about how to write a true crime book. So, you know, many years later, that was in 1959 that the Clutter family was murdered. And they started the reporting for In Cold Blood. And she made a couple of subsequent trips with him. But by 1977, she basically, when she found out about the Reverend Maxwell, decided to write her own true crime story.
Well, tell us some more about from about 1959 and 1960, what was happening in Harper Lee's life and what was happening in the In Cold Blood life.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Capote and Lee were up living in New York, pretty far away from Alabama, but she had just finished To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, she had just finished the draft. It had taken her a long time. She had moved to New York in 1949. She dropped out of law school at the University of Alabama, and she wanted to be a writer, but she'd never taken a creative writing class, and she struggled with these little stories and sketches, and finally she got together a draft, and that was called Ghost at a Watchman, but nobody would publish it. But there was an editor who read Ghost at a Watchman.
Excuse me for interrupting you. I'm so
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
Go Tell Watchman is the book that came out last year.
Yeah, so it came out. It seemed like her sequel, her second book, but it was actually the very first thing she ever wrote. So it's a little confusing because the characters are aged up. Atticus is older. Scout is a young woman. But technically, it's the first version of the story she wrote. And a very talented editor read it and said, I don't like this novel, but I like these characters and I like this setting. Let's make a novel out of that. And that's actually the story of Mockingbird. It was a revision of that earlier work.
It came out of it. It was birthed out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
But for me, I remember those times. And
sure.
Then the 1959, 1960, 61 was an interesting, painful time in the history of civil rights and the adjustments that those of us in the South were having to make. And I was interested, as you described, some of the reasons why Watchmen was not going to make it, because it dealt with more directly with the confrontations that we were having in the South about race.
Yeah. I mean, I think just to remind folks who are listening, so Mockingbird is set during the Great Depression. And it's the reason a lot of people don't realize Harper Lee lived until 2016, because they think, you know, she was dead already in 1960, because that book takes place in the 1930s. But she was very much alive, and she was living through the transitions you're talking about. And, you know, those were social transitions and national transitions, but as far as she was concerned, they were really personal. You know, she had a father who was more conservative than she ever realized as a kid, and she'd had a very liberalizing experience at the University of Alabama. She was basically, folks called her a beatnik. You know, she was a real cynic and a kind of personality on campus, and, you know, she was sharp and witty and critical, and then she went and moved to the big city of New York, where, you know, she encountered integrated lifestyles. And I think that, you know, Watchmen is a messy novel, and it's not as good as Mockingbird, but politically it's really sophisticated.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And you see her working through, you know, it'd be wrong to reduce them to daddy issues, but you see her trying to make sense of people who struck her as good, intrinsically good, but who socially weren't. You know, they were not treating their black neighbors the way that they should have. And while they were adjusting in kind of interpersonal ways, so they might have been friendly to their black maid, they were opposing, you know, structural change in their society. And
they were not Klan members, but they were racist in a systemic way,
right? Exactly. And that for Harper Lee was really interesting, that you had people, right, who hated the Klan, but were not pro-equality, you know, mm-hmm. who didn't want blacks to be lynched, but didn't want them to be at their church or at the lunch counter with them, or worse, in their kids' schools. And that's, you know, again, it was a very ambitious novel. She was trying to make sense of the kind of everyday embedded racism that I think, look, we still struggle to talk about today. And there was young Harper Lee in the 1950s trying to write boldly about it. And, you know, what she found was a bunch of squeamish publishers who said, you know, no, let's not have, you know, such a complicated villain. Let's give everybody a Bob Yule they can really hate. And let's give them an Atticus Finch who's purely heroic. And let's make this kind of moral a little more parable-like, a little less messy, a little cleaner, a little more palatable. And that's the story of that revision process. She was working with a really heavy-handed editor who said, you know, let's give them a story they'll want.
Well, you tell that story so nicely, and you have to, like, we have this legend in North Carolina about Thomas Wolfe and how his editor.
Yeah, this is a Max Perkins, exactly.
Turned it around, and the raw talent was with the writer, but the.
Right. She was not, to be clear, a graphomaniac like Thomas Wolfe. They weren't editing down thousands of pages. She was not delivering, you know, trunks full of manuscript. But you're exactly right. It's that kind of a relationship, an editor who said, you know, you have a story you need to tell. Let me help you do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and ultimately what that meant was restricting the chronology of the book and making a little more of a plot. You know, before it was an argument, and Mockingbird became a plot.
Well, and so Mockingbird had just been sold, or was in the final stages.
And she was out of money. The truth is she had gotten in advance and she was out of money. So when Capote said, you know, I'll pay you to go with me to help me do this reporting in Kansas, she said yes, not just because they were friends, but because she needed the money.
And he was offering $900, which was a lot of money for
her.
It may be $2,000 or $3,000, $4,000 in today's dollars, maybe, but
yeah, it was more than she was being offered anywhere else since she'd had these kind of
cruddy
jobs.
She's getting ready to be the most successful author we've ever known, and she signs on with her old buddy to go out to Kansas to do something that we didn't know. Tell us what happened in
Sure,
Kansas.
Yeah. So the thing to know is Harper Lee loved true crime. She loved murder stories. As a kid, she liked reading Sherlock Holmes. She liked to sit in on trials. And so most of us would have said no to Capote, but she said yes. It was a very grisly murder story. It was a whole family that had been murdered in their home, and no one knew who did it. It was in this small town out in Kansas. And the truth is a lot of the folks in town were still scared. You know, the murderers had not been apprehended. The police didn't know who did it. But Capote said to the New Yorker, I want to go write a story about how murder affects a small town and how a town makes sense of crime. So she went with him even before they knew who had done it. And, you know, they turned up in town. And the truth is a lot of people in that town in Kansas were worried Capote might have been the murderer because he was so strange and weird and showed up at this, you know, inopportune moment. But, you know, there was Nell, plain and kind and warm and empathetic. And she really helped him with the lion's share of that reporting.
You describe in such wonderful detail about how she mastered the details while Truman was kind of flitting around. She got the story organized.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good scholarship about In Cold Blood, and I want to make sure to acknowledge some of the folks who have written about it before. And because of their research, too, we know a lot about that process. And some folks listening might have seen Capote or Infamous. There were these two great biopics about Capote and the writing of In Cold Blood. And, you know, in one, Harper Lee is played by Sandra Bullock, and in the other, she's played by Catherine Kenner. And in both films, she's represented just as a very dutiful, organized assistant. And she went back to the hotel every night and typed up her notes and, you know, was accurate and precise and got the dialogue down. And Capote, meanwhile, was just, you know, freewheeling and claimed he had a perfect memory, although sometimes said it was 97%, sometimes said it was 98%, sometimes 99% recall. So luckily she was there to actually make notes and keep a robust record.
Could based on what I read in your book, I thought Capote never would have been able to write this book had he not had the resources that she provided him. And so am
sure.
I off base on that? Or?
I don't want to underestimate him. I mean, I'm sure he could have written something, but I don't know that it would ever have been as scrupulous or precise as it is without her. That's really the advantage she had is that, you know, she went and got the facts and figures and the dialogue and the detail.
Well, I think the point that you're trying to make, and I'm just taking you all over the world to keep you from saying that this gave her a real inside look at writing a mystery story. And so when we come back after a break, we'll talk about how she tried to put this to work later on. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Casey Sepp. We're talking about her book, Fabulous Furious Hours, and she and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. My guest is Casey Sepp. She's a risen star in the writing community. And Casey, you're so modest about it, but many of us would die if we could get an assignment like Truman Capote did and like you did to write for The New Yorker.
Oh, gosh. Well, it's very kind of you to say. And, you know, it's a wonderful magazine with a very storied history. And it's always been a pleasure for me to write for the magazine. And it's true, the book grew out of some reporting for The New Yorker. And I was a little bit haunted by the specter of Capote for that reason. You know, there's a lot of pressure when you think about those pages.
Well, that's great. And maybe we can talk some more about your own writing experience. But right now, I'd like for you to talk about how the experience that Harper Lee had working with Truman Capote on the In Cold Blood book led to something for her to do as people wanted her to write another book, you know, after her gangbuster first book.
Yeah. So the thing to know is, you know, this true crime story, this story of, you know, a reverend accused of killing five family members and the lawyer who defended him, who then defended the vigilante who murdered him, you know, this sensational story, it came Harper Lee's way in the 1970s. And the thing to know about her career at that point is, yes, Mockingbird had been a huge success, but it had been 17 years before. And people, you know, were wondering, when was she ever going to publish another book? And she had tried over and over again to write a novel, and she wasn't getting any traction, and she couldn't finish one, and she had abandoned a couple efforts, and so then she turned to this nonfiction project, which I think would seem strange if it weren't for the assistance she gave Capote with In Cold Blood. It really provided a model for her, not just of the kind of book she wanted to write, but the kind of reporting she needed to do. So she picked up and moved to this town in Alabama for 9 months and moved into
a
motel
where the
murder took place. So
which murder are you talking about now?
So she moved to Alexander City. So that's kind of the big town around Lake Martin, and that's where some of the trials had been.
This is in southeastern
Alabama.
Eastern Alabama.
Exactly. So if folks know,
I guess near Columbus, near for the big town.
It's not far from Auburn.
Auburn and Columbus.
Yeah, it's not far from Auburn. And some folks might know Lake Martin. She actually, you know, Harper Lee had good taste. She picked a story that took her to kind of one of the most beautiful parts of Alabama. And there's a funny thread in the book about just how frugal and cheap Harper Lee was. So the other thing to know is she had a niece who had married a guy who owned a motel in town. So she didn't have to pay to move into the motel. She had a place to stay. And so she moved to Alexander City for 9 months. And she went around and she interviewed just the same way she and Capote had, the lawyers,
yeah,
the judge, everybody involved in the case.
Just for the benefit of those people tuning in late, this is the trial of the man who killed the reverend, the preacher,
who had been murdering
his kinfolks and collecting insurance policy.
Right. This so that's the trial. So the reverend was gunned down in June of 1977, but the trial of the man who shot him wasn't until September. So by September, Harper Lee had come to town, and she was planning to write her book.
It wasn't like this was hidden in Alabama. This got attention across the country.
Oh, sure, yeah. It was covered in the New York Times. The truth is, you know, when I was trying to figure out, so there's this famous story, Capote found in cold blood by this, like, little squib in the New York Times. And, of course, everybody loves an origin story or the genesis of a project. And actually couldn't nail down exactly how she had first heard about it because the Reverend story got so much press. Her sisters would have read about it in their local papers in Alabama. It was covered in the New York Times, which she read regularly, and it was just a sensational case. So there are a lot of different ways she could have found out about it.
Did she really immediately just say, hey, this is just for me. I know Alabama, and I know how to do this kind of
stuff. With a book like mine, you're relying on interviews with people who knew her, and you're relying a lot on letters she wrote. So I don't have a letter that's the first moment she found out about it. But what she told people in town when she showed up was she was going to write a book. So she knew it was a killer idea, and she knew there was enough material for a book project. So that's what she said. And more specifically, she told them, you know, I'm writing a nonfiction book. I want just the facts. I'm doing old-fashioned, straight-laced journalism. So she really deliberately was letting them know this was not going to be Mockingbird. This was going to be an In Cold Blood type book.
While she was there, she got to know the lawyer who was representing the person who was accused of killing the Reverend. And tell us about him.
Sure. Yeah. She got to know Harper Lee did a lot of people in this town, but one of her main sources was this guy, Tom Radney. And Tom Radney was an interesting figure. He had had a, you know, fairly sensational political career before he settled into small town lawyering. But he did a lot of criminal defense and he did a lot of civil litigation. He would kind of take any case he could get. And that meant when his former client, the Reverend Maxwell, was gunned down at the funeral of his last alleged victim, Tom Radney then went and took the case of the man who had murdered his former client. And so Harper Lee, you know, this was an important source for her. This was someone who had known the Reverend for 10 years. This was someone who knew the ins and outs of the murder investigations, of the life insurance fraud cases, and who then knew the story of the vigilante. So he was an important source, and she spent a lot of time with him, and he gave her a lot of documents from, you know, all the years he had represented these folks. And
what was his motive? Did he want to be in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think understandably, you know, this was, you know, the case of a lifetime for Tom Radney. And, you know, he liked press in general. He had an appetite for it from when he was a politician. And part of the reason he was such a good trial lawyer is he just liked an audience. And, you know, whether it was, you know, 10,000 people at a campaign speech or 12 people on a jury, he liked a crowd. And so I think, you know, from his perspective, it didn't get any better than the state's most famous writer coming to town to write a book about you. And he wanted to be as helpful as possible.
He also, just interestingly enough, it sounded like quite a character. There's some suspicion that he may have not improperly, but couldn't admire the way that he worked with the Reverend to help perpetuate what you could argue was a fraud on. And, I mean, he was sort of tainted with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of important thing to notice is, right, she found this interesting lawyer. And in a lot of ways, he was heroic. You know, he had been fairly progressive as far as
he was a Kennedy liberal. Time when Alabama was
during the Wallace years. Right. So, you know, in some straightforward ways, he was heroic, but he wasn't a pure hero. You know, and I think if you talk to people in the black community, they felt like he was profiteering. You know, the Reverend had been accused over and over again of these crimes. And, you know, a different lawyer, maybe someone was entitled to a criminal defense, but they didn't need someone helping them to go after the insurance companies
like
to make money.
Like being a lawyer to the mafia in some respects.
Exactly. I think that's
a
good analogy, right? We rightfully scrutinize the decisions a lawyer makes. And in the case of Tom Radney, this was a very profitable client. And he built a new law office a few years into representing the Reverend. And folks around Alexander City called it the Maxwell House because it was the house that Maxwell built. You know, it was a new brick law office right next door to the courthouse. And, you know, he's living high on the hog. And it was because of the Maxwell. It was one of the most profitable clients he had. And so, right, depending on where you sat, you know, if you were a relative of the Reverend and you didn't want him to get away with this, or if you were someone in the black community, or if you were someone who, God forbid, worked for the life insurance company, right, you had a different opinion of Tom Radney than some other folks did. So he was a divisive figure.
Well, you tell the story, but the one of the tragedies for me in the story of Tom Radney is that as hard as he worked and hard as he worked to get material to Harper Lee for the book just was never written.
Yeah, and
all of that went away. He died without being famous.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's an important point. Again, there I was talking about the kind of complexity of Tom Radney's character. I think it has to be said that Harper Lee is a complicated character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the book, it might seem like she's the hero because she's the most famous person and she was a very successful novelist. But, you know, in a lot of straightforward ways, she was a failure, not just with this book, but with some others. And, right, she came to this town and entered into the kind of relationships with sources where they thought she was going to do something with their story, and she never did. And that wasn't just Tom. That was other people in town, too.
Well, I want you – was this project that Harper Lee set for herself – as it turned out, did it, because she was, for various reasons, was it going to be an impossible project to make this book something that people would read?
Boy, I mean, Harper Lee is a much better writer than I am, and I managed to write this book. Now, I was lucky I got to make her into a character. You know, a third of the book is about her life and her work on this case. And so I don't know that it was intrinsically impossible. I think probably if you want to come back, we'll talk more about the things that made it hard for her to write in general and things that were mm-hmm. particularly hard about this book. But, yeah, I'm not sure that it was intrinsically impossible.
Well, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with Casey Sepp. She's the author of Furious Hours, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Casey Sepp. Casey is brand new to us, but she's not new in the writing community. She's written for The New Yorker. She's also... I think on the road to stardom, and I hope we'll remember this interview. She's grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland, went to Harvard, and then as a Rhodes Scholar to Oxford, where she got her MPhil degree.
Yeah. MPhil degree. It's their fancy name for a master's, yeah. And it's a master's of philosophy no matter what you study, which I just think makes it very confusing.
Makes it easy, but you were interested in religion.
Yeah, so I did that degree in religion.
Is that what got you interested in this story, that you were interested in the reverend, not as a con man and as a murderer, but as a theologian and a preacher?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, look, straightforwardly, I came to this story the way a lot of people will, which is Harper Lee. But the reason I wanted to stick with it, I wrote a short article about it and then turned it into this book. And I do find the Reverend to be a very interesting character. And I think that religious authority is such an important thing to reckon with in our communities, because it's not so much that I think it's an interesting question whether the Reverend was sincere in his beliefs and what sincerity can look like. But I just think in general it's important to think about how we relate to spiritual authority. And in the case of the Reverend, one of the reasons this went on for so long is a lot of people defer to the clergy. And, you know, a lot of people thought at first it couldn't possibly be true. And, of course, it took a second wife dying for them to really put it all together. And so that's interesting to me. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the kind of weird rumors that grew up around the Reverend Maxwell.
No,
right.
You know, if we're going to talk about religion, let's talk about voodoo.
I was about to say. So, you know, poor Harper Lee, the headlines around this case, and there's a photo in the book of just the kind of national headlines, and they're voodoo priest, voodoo cleric, you know, voodoo shaman. When the Reverend kept getting away with this, people decided he was not a Baptist minister, that he was a voodoo priest, and that he was using voodoo to hex the jury, and, you know, he was using spells and potions to kill these people, and that's why the coroners couldn't find, you know, an appropriate cause of death. And so, you know, I didn't know much about voodoo, but it was fun to research it. It's a legitimate system of belief. There's a long history of it in the South, and so that for me was a lot of fun because I'm interested in religion.
But there was really no real evidence that he...
So voodoo is real, but there's no evidence that the Reverend dabbled in voodoo. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those tricky things. You know, we were talking before the break about why this book was hard for Harper Lee. And I think that's a really good example. You know, it's odd to write about something like voodoo, which, again, is real, but was not real in this case. And, you know, meaning you're obliged to sort of account for it because it's how people talk about this story. I mean, literally people said the Reverend could turn into a black cat. And I thought they were just pulling my leg when I was looking into it. But Harper Lee adopted a stray cat when she was living in this town, and she called it Reverend Maxwell because there were already these stories about black cats and about his spiritual powers. And so I think for Harper Lee, who wanted just the facts and was planning to write, you know, a narrative nonfiction book, it was hard for her to figure out what to do with something like voodoo because, right, straightforwardly, the Reverend was not a voodoo. There's no evidence. He dabbled in voodoo. He ever studied it. He ever practiced it. But that doesn't mean you can get rid of that from your book. You have to talk about it because it's how people talk about it.
So they did talk about it. One of the things that you mentioned that Harper Lee may have been an obstacle for her in completing this work was that while she had a tremendous talent for making people feel comfortable and talking, and she was warm and just amazingly drew conversation from them. Well, that worked, as you point out, with white people, but it was more difficult in dealing with a large number of black people. She was fine dealing with the people who worked for her family at home and black servants, but when she got out there in the real black community.
Yeah. I should say, first of all, you're talking about her being a great conversationalist. You know, as I gather, it was like talking to you, DJ, that people really felt comfortable and she was good at asking questions and she made time to talk to them. And so, right, you know, on the one hand, the reason she was so helpful to Capote and the reason her work started to go well with the Maxwell case is she was good at it and authentic and sincere and made people comfortable sharing even these dark stories of their lives. But, right, there are, you know, there are differences in different communities and different people and differences of gender and class and race in particular. And so, right, you know, this was black-on-black crime. These were marginal black communities in some of the poorest regions of Alabama. And, you know, Harper Lee at that point was a rich and famous novelist. And she had to figure out how to engage. Right.
Will you deal with this challenge in such a wonderful way, telling the three stories, one of Harper Lee, one of Radley and then of the preacher himself,
right,
the Reverend himself. Now, I really do want you to talk about your experience writing. How did you get – you came back home after your experience in Oxford. Had you already been writing and getting paid for writing, or how did that start?
Boy, so I had, you know, I was just a little like Harper Lee. So when she was in college, she had done some newspaper writing and wrote
Crimson, for the Crimson.
Yeah, so she wrote for the Crimson White, and I wrote for the Crimson. And I had written for my, you know, college literary magazine, and I loved writing, and
so
I loved
reading. So
you're
writing fiction, or are you writing?
Embarrassingly, I was writing very bad fiction for the literary magazine. But, you know, I was writing newspaper articles and columns and things like that. And so when I came back, I had studied religion, and I did more theological studies because I'm interested in religion, and you know, I just think it's such an important cultural force in America.
And so are you writing about religion?
Yeah, so a lot of what I ended up doing was covering, you know, I wrote some about the schism in the Methodist Church over LGBT.
Oh, wow.
LGBT.
Who are you writing for?
For the New Yorker. So I did a piece for them about one of those
about
early—
About the Methodist challenge.
About the split, yeah.
And basically on the ordination issue of—
it was sort of built around—it was mostly looking at one Methodist minister who had been defrocked for performing his daughter's—he officiated his daughter's wedding. And, you know, the Methodists have this curious polity where even though his church had been very comfortable and happy to celebrate that, you know, another parish in Texas had not been, and so he was— You know, ecclesiastical court was convened, and he was defrocked. And so I wrote about that. And, you know, I wrote about a lot of things. I wrote about Flannery O'Connor's prayer journal, and I wrote about, just some books about religion I was reviewing.
Were these assignments, or were these things that you brought to the magazines you speculatively or got a—
It's a great question, and there's a little bit of, it's kind of like speed dating. You know, sometimes an editor brings you an idea, and sometimes you bring them an idea, and you kind of hope to meet somewhere
but
in the middle.
You develop relationships with the editors when they, and they trust you. They may not go for every idea that you've got, but they would like to find something that they needed that you could write.
Right. And I was lucky to have people who kind of knew what I was interested in books and religion. And
it was mainly for the New Yorker?
I actually have a piece in this weekend's New York Times Book Review. So some other places too. And, you know, the nice thing, I came of age as a writer when the internet was coming of age. And so even a place like the New Yorker, where they can only run a certain number of articles in the magazine, you know, you could write more for the web and get experience there and do different kinds of writing too.
Tell me about that. Did you get paid for the web?
Yeah.
The same rate?
Yes, or? Thankfully they pay for everything. And the truth is everybody has kind of moved to the web model where, you know, there's money for writers. And I think it's a good experience for people who are interested in writing. And one of the nice things about the book tour has just been the chance to talk to people about how you write a book and how you take an idea and shape it and find a structure. And I feel really lucky I had the kind of training wheels of magazine journalism, because you can sort of think of a book like this as a series of magazine articles mm-hmm. that you have to kind of draw the shoestrings together so the shoe fits. And so I felt really lucky. I had actually, you know, probably about 10 years when I was doing freelance work, and not always full time. Sometimes
years after you got back from
no, I started when I was in grad school, and so, you know, just time on the side of even when I was in grad school doing book reviews and cultural criticism and that kind of thing.
So when you're in England, you're doing this? Are you in
grad school? did a few book reviews and things like that when I was at Oxford.
This is interesting. So just in a 30 seconds, what's next? Or can we look for another book, or are we just...
Yeah, I mean, look, unless you have 39 million listeners who are all going to buy a copy of the book, I can't live off the royalties like Harper Lee did. So I'm hoping to write another book and have a couple of things cooking for The New Yorker right now. So, yeah, I'll keep busy writing.
I think the best way, since you won't tell us what your next book is that the way to keep up with you is keep an eye on The New Yorker might be the best way.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Once every couple of months we'll see something?
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty hard to be more prolific than that. But I think book two hopefully will be in the next few years. And hopefully, I'm looking into a shipwreck story. So it'll be pretty different from this, but it'll be another kind of mystery, if that makes sense.
I can't wait. Casey Sepp is the author of Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. She's also a wonderful guest. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.